Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's Sunday, March 1st, 2009. This is Solder Smoke 102. Just starting off this morning with some travelogue. I've been on the road this week. We went down into the shadow of Vesuvius. That sounds a whole lot more picturesque than a trip to Naples, but that's what it was. We had to go down there for a few days, and mostly tourism, and had a really good time. It's a beautiful city. Naples has sort of among Italian cities, I guess Naples is kind of the bad boy. Has kind of a bad rep, and I think a lot of it is undeserved. We went there. I had never really been into Naples before. Been around it, but never really went into the heart of the city. So we did, and this time we went in there, and it really a beautiful place, an amazing city. People were really, really nice, and all of the kind of negative images that are out there about Naples for us were completely eliminated, and really a very, very interesting place. Beautiful right there, you know, on the water, and just great. Vesuvius also is very interesting. You have it's you know, looming over you the whole time that you're there, and it was snow-capped at this point. Not really quite completely snow-capped, but there was snow up on the top of it. We're going to climb it. It's not that difficult to get to the top. You could drive up a good portion of the way, and then at the point that you have to leave your car, they tell me there's about a half-hour hike to get to the top. But Billy and his school class sometime this year are going to be going there. They're going to visit Pompeii and maybe, I think, Herculaneum, because they're studying ancient Rome. And while they're there as part of the trip, they get to climb Vesuvius. So I am trying to arrange for myself to be one of the accompanying parents to get up there to climb to the top of Vesuvius. A couple of people were writing in about the fact that one of the interesting things about living in Italy is that there's so much history literally underneath your feet. And I was reminded of this when in a couple of the stores that we were visiting in the Naples area. You'd be going along in the supermarket or kind of in the department store, and all of a sudden you'd look down, you'd notice you were standing on these very very thick glass panels. And what they were doing is they were displaying what they had found underneath the store when they built it, just you know, a few yards below the earth, there'd be all kinds of ancient Roman ruins down there, and some of it going back to Greek times too, because there's a lot of that in the Naples area. So, thumbs up for Napoli. We had the traditional pizza there; that was great. Beautiful city. I recommend it. As long as we're in the travelogue, I just wanted to share with you guys. I don't know if I've done this before, but you know, we've talked about different words are used in relation to ham radio in the Italian language, and one of my favorite is the way they describe, not necessarily a shack, but the way they describe kind of an electronic workshop. When I first got here, I was trying to describe to people why I was moving this workbench and all these tools and everything into one of the rooms here in the apartment, and I kept using the wrong word. I was using words that would have been that we would have used or close to it in Spanish or Portuguese, and that just wasn't wasn't doing it. So I did some research, and the word that you would use in Italian to describe this kind of a workshop is, and I love it, laboratorio. It seems to be, I don't know, to call what I have here a laboratory, it seems a little bit over the top, but it sounds good. And they do use this word for just about any kind of workshop that's not related to an automobile or a motor scooter. They use a different word for that, but for like a workshop where a guy is fixing watches, you'll see a laboratorio. Or an electronic workshop, laboratorio. So anyway, that's where I work, here in the laboratorio. All right. Hey, speaking of working in the laboratorio, just 1 second. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Speaking of the laboratorio, I've been thinking a lot about QRSS and we've been having a lot of success with QRSS. A lot of new stations are popping up in the U.S. and in Canada. A lot of grabber stations on the receive side, a lot of transmit stations, putting out some very interesting signals. And we've all been having a lot of fun with it. But, you know, I was thinking about one of the really nice things about QRSS is that it's a mode that is in which people who are at the kind of low-tech side of the hobby can participate, but there's also a big place in QRS for people who are at the more advanced high-tech side of the hobby. Let me explain. On the transmit side, you know, I was thinking about this. You could have a QRSS transmitter working perfectly well with just one transistor. Or one tube, if you wanted to get a little bit kind of retro. This is an area where QRSS matches up with one of the other big movements or little movements in the QRP world, and that's minimalist radio. But you know, you could have on the transmit side, you could have an extremely simple station using just one transistor. Now, I know some of you are thinking about, what about the keyer? Well, I'm thinking if we really wanted to keep it simple, and I remember seeing something about this before, but if we really wanted to keep it simple, you could come up with a mechanical keyer for QRSS based perhaps on an ordinary clock drive. Just a second hand going around on a clock. If you put some sort of a disc on that, just a small metal disc, you could basically paint out or use electrical tape to block out the key down periods, and so there you'd have just the clock would be running, and you could set up some electrical connection to the disc that is being driven by the second hand, and as the thing sweeps around each minute, your little mechanical device would be keying your one transistor transmitter, sending out a few milliwatts or a few tens of milliwatts to the universe on 10.140050 megahertz. So on the transmit side, we can go down to one transistor. Now, on the receive side, it's an entirely different story. We're on completely the opposite end of the technological spectrum, because it's on the receive side that the real magic takes place in QRSS that allows these very, very weak signals, these signals that are in any other receivers, in any other kind of receive system below the noise, that allows these signals to be heard. Because, of course, on the receive side, it's the DSP, it's the digital signal processing that allows us to make use of what are in effect filters that are down at the kind of 1 hertz bandwidth, and that's what allows QRSS to function. We would never be able to do it if we were actually trying to listen with our ears to a receiver with a passband of 500 hertz. There's just no way. But when you narrow that filter down to one hertz, you block out all of that noise, and your little QRSS signal pops up on on the screen and is sent out to the waiting world by some grabber operator out there. My favorite grabber is ON5EX, Johan up there in Belgium. My signal is happily marching across his screen just about every day from sunrise to sunset. So think about that. On the transmit side, we can get away with a transmitter with one transistor. How many transistors are there on the receive side? I was thinking about this. Well, I did some Googling on this, and it looks like in your typical kind of Pentium 4 home computer, just in the CPU, there's somewhere in the area of 50 to 100 million transistors. So okay, on the transmit side, we're getting away with one. On the receive side, you need about 50 to 100 million of them. Anyway, for me, that was it's kind of an interesting thought, and it's a reminder of how how QRSS is such a good mode for us, because it's this this marriage of high tech and low tech, and minimalist radio and QRP and homebrew. It's all there in QRSS, guys. I'm telling you, this is the this is a fun mode. I think it was because of this kind of high tech appeal that we managed to get an article about QRSS on the very well known blog or high tech page known as Hackaday. I don't know if you guys watch Hackaday, but Mike and I used to watch Hackaday every day. And I still do, most days. it's a technically oriented blog. It's got some real good articles in there. Most of it is oriented towards the kind of high-tech software computer hacking, looking at making modifications to iPhones, things like that. It's not necessarily our kind of radio homebrew. But the guy who runs Hackaday, Elliot, is interested in ham radio, especially where the hobby touches up against the areas of interest of most of his readers. So it occurred to me that that QRSS might be of interest. So I wrote up a very short little article, and it was with the title something like "Radio Amateurs Go for Slow Speed Narrow Band." You know, while the rest of the world is going for high-speed broadband, those of us in the QRSS game are going for low-speed narrowband. And I give a few lines of communication theory about why you would need, narrowband to make QRSS work. And anyway, Elliot ran the article, and it had an effect. I watched the number of visitors to the soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog page, and on a typical day there's about 150 visitors to that page, and I'm delighted to have 150 visitors a day. It's fine, but after the Hackaday article ran, the hit count for the following day went up to 899. So we had a lot of people looking at QRSS, and I noticed that the hit count on our blog page has remained higher than it was before. It's up around 250 a day. So hopefully we brought some new readers in, and maybe some people will get the knack and start melting solder on some of these kind of projects. I have a couple stories about QRSS that were for me it kind of illustrates the fun of this mode. I think I mentioned before that I can watch my own QRSS signals on my BlackBerry as I travel around. I have bookmarked Johan's page, the ON5EX grabber, and I can watch it. And like most homes in Europe and certainly in Italy, Italian apartments and Italian houses are wired for the use of far less electricity than we're accustomed to in the United States. So what happens is whenever an American family moves into one of these apartments or one of these or a home, we bring along all the American appliances, and we end up very frequently, or well, somewhat frequently, blowing the circuit breakers. And that happens from time to time here. If we get the washing machine and the dryer and the dishwasher and a couple other things going, the circuit breaker blows, and we have to. It's no big deal. You just go and you flip the breaker, you turn off a few things, and you flip the breaker back on. But of course, this has an effect on my QRSS beacon, because it shuts down the transmitter, and it shuts off the keyer. So my beautiful frequency shift keying signal that's normally marching triumphantly across Johan's screen turns into just a flat line, because the transmitter's on, but the keyer is not keying it. Because what'll happen is I'll be off at work, the power will go out, my wife will throw the circuit breaker back on, but you know she's not going to remember that she needs to turn on the K1 EL keyer on the QRSS transmitter. So I can tell every once in a while at work, if I'm taking a look, I can see if I see a flat line going across there at 10140050. I know that the power has been out, but has been turned back on back home. So this is the kind of information that you can have at your fingertips in the QRSS game. Another little story. Yesterday, I was keeping an eye on the grabbers, and I noticed that on Johan's grabber, I could see my signal there, and I was looking early in the morning here, about 0730. UTC. I was taking a look at the grabber, and I noticed that there seemed to be another square wave signal kind of buried underneath mine on Johan's grabber. So I decided to give the other fella a chance to be seen, and I shut down my transmitter, waited a couple minutes for Johan's grabber to refresh, and there it was, VK2ZAY. My friend Alan in Australia, his QRSS frequency shift keying square wave was booming in. I mean, really coming in strong. It must have been, well, it was. It was gray line time, so he was coming in quite strong. I immediately got on the Knights of the QRSS mailing list and put out a message alerting everyone to the fact that VK2ZAY was booming in on Johan's grabber. And I kind of wondered. I said, I wonder if I had a shot at being picked up by some of the VK grabbers, especially VK6DI. Anyway, I decided to take a look. So I waited a few minutes to make sure that Alan had a chance to be seen, and then I turned on my grabber. My beacon again, and started to keep an eye. I took a look at David VK6DI's grabber down there in the Perth area, but you know it was blank. It was off. He turned it off. And as I was sitting there wondering what was going on, another email came in, and it was from David VK6DI, and he said that he would like to take a shot at seeing if he could pick up my little 50 milliwatt a beacon. But we had some bad luck, because at the time thunderstorms were all around his QTH in Perth, and so he had to shut the gear down. He even sent along a little display of the thunderstorm activity in the Perth area. So we're going to try again some other time here. David is going to pull up stakes and move to VK2 sometime in April. But between now and then, he's going to try to reorient some of his antennas, aim them up here at the EU area, and see if I can be picked up by the VK6DI grabber. But it was kind of an interesting little DX adventure with the QRSS and the MEPT beacons yesterday morning. Thanks to David for that, and congratulations to Alan for getting his signals all the way up here on the other side of the world. I've been talking to Jerry NR5A about a beacon transmitter that he is working on. I don't know if it was a wise decision, but he decided to try to reproduce the circuit that I'm using for my beacon transmitter. And he asked me about the circuit, and I had to dig around and try to remember where it came from. And I went back to a blog entry that I had put out about it, and I realized that this is one of those examples where there's quite a bit of soul in that little machine. We're always talking about soul in the new machine, based on the a phrase that comes from the title of the book by Tracy Kidder. If I have Billy help me wind a toroidal coil, or if Maria helps me paint the cabinet on a power supply, I kind of think of that new device as having a lot more personality, a lot more character, a lot more soul in the new machine, as Tracy Kidder would put it. And I had forgotten that this QRSS beacon has quite a bit of soul in the machine, because when I tried to figure out where the oscillator circuit in it came from, I realized that it came from a discussion that I had with Billy while on a transatlantic flight coming back to Europe from the Dominican Republic. We were sitting on an airplane, and I guess I must have been reading something technical, and he was looking over my shoulder, and he started asking me about the schematics and where radio signals come from and all that. And so I pulled out a little piece of paper and started explaining about the schematics, and we drew up a little oscillator circuit right there, kind of back of the envelope, almost literally on the back of the envelope on the airplane coming back. And I told him, I said, look, when we get back, we'll put this thing together, we'll make it, and we'll make some radio waves. So we got back, I think we were in London at the time, and we threw together a little oscillator circuit and fired it up. And then for a while, we were playing Find the Oscillator in the House. We were, I hooked it up to a little 9-volt battery, and I'd hide it someplace in the house, and I'd give him the little Sony shortwave receiver with the BFO on, and have him go around and try to find out where the signal was strongest and track the radio down. A little bit of radio direction finding inside the London house. Well, anyway, when I guess a year or so later, when I decided to get into the QRSS game, I looked around in the junk box, and there was this little oscillator circuit there, and I popped out the 20-meter crystal, popped in the 30-meter crystal, and that was the origin. That was the oscillator circuit. And then I built up used a little amplifier that I had built up based on kind of the oscillator design discussions that Mike KL7R and I were having. Had been built the amplifier stages had been built up with the assistance of LT Spice. Anyway, that's what it is. That's what's painting the signal across Johann's beacon, across Johann's grabber screen, and quite a bit of soul in that little machine. By the way, speaking of Johann's grabber, I've figured out a way to put the visual display from his grabber up on the blog page, on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. And you'll see it there in the upper right when you visit the page. And that's pretty much a live display of Johann's receiver. You might have to hit the refresh button on your web browser to make sure that it's up to date. But that's pretty much live, and depending on what time you're looking, if the sun is up over Europe these days, you're almost always going to see my little square wave signal marching along the middle of Johann's screen. He's got the screen broken into two parts, so that you get more time displayed. But in both the bottom, in the lower and the upper segments, right around the middle of the band, you'll see a little upside-down square wave signal. And if you read along the bottom, you can read I0 stroke N2 CQR being repeated incessantly, slowly, across the grabber screen. It's weird propagation, but it's probably just one good skip, one good hop. It's about 750 miles, but I am just rock steady into Johan's part of Belgium from sun up to sundown. Lately, the conditions seem to be improving a little bit because I even after the sun goes down, my signal's in there for an hour or so. But so we may be starting to see some improvements in propagation. The Johan put a little sun clock display down below it, and he's got a great chart in there showing ionospheric conditions also on his grabber. I haven't quite figured out how to read that chart yet, but it looks to be very, very useful. And this is all a reminder of how useful the QRSS signals and the QRSS system is for propagation studies. I mean, you could really tell whether the band is open in a certain direction. If a 50 milliwatt signal or a 10 milliwatt signal is getting through on the path you're interested in, well, it's a good indication that the band is going to be open. Some miscellaneous QRSS news here. K6HX, Mark, has started transmitting with DFs CW. I think it's for discrete frequency CW. Basically, the when you look at the display up, I think up is if the signal goes up, it's a dot, and if it goes down, it's a dash. But the dashes on display, the length of the characters on the display are the same. Really interesting, and I think that system's got a lot of potential. And Mark's been putting out signals, been picked up by grabbers there. Wanted to mention I got some great support from K1EL. I use his keyer here in my beacon, and I did something to it. I was in the course of experimenting. I think I fried the chip. You guys know from listening to the show that this happens from time to time here in the laboratorio. We're not going to talk about the sad story of the CMOS chip with the 32 different soldering connections and the upside down chip. Well, we won't go into that sad story. Enough of that. But I managed to damage another chip, and it was the chip in the K1EL keyer, and I wrote off to K1EL, and he was kind enough to pop a new one in the mail, and I just popped it back into the keyer, and everything is right in the keyer department here. So thanks very much to K1EL for great support. If you guys are looking for a good keyer for your QRSS system, look no further. K1EL is the place to go in a number of different QRSS modes. Certainly QRSS3 are supported by his keyer, and that's all you need to get on the air. Build up a little transmitter and off you go. Just wanted to mention that the contribution that Italians have been making, Italian hams have been making to the QRSS world, all kinds of important developments in QRSS come from Italy. First of all, a number of the aggregators that we look at, these are the websites that take multiple QRSS grabbers and put them all on one screen, so you could do kind of an at a glance look at where signals are moving around the world. Italian hams have two of the most important aggregators up there. Also, quite a bit of the software that we're working with, Argo, for example, on the receive side, is put together by some very creative Italian hams. I think the call sign, and I wish I had the screen up to give the accurate information, but I1 PhD, I think, is one of the originators of this software. And I was interested to see that the Italians have a 10-meter QRSS beacon network set up with quite a few stations active. I haven't seen whether they have grabbers on the air, but it's interesting that they've built quite an extensive QRSS beacon network on 10 meters. I'll have to take some more look, take more look at that, see what's going on there, because it certainly seems interesting. And one final QRSS note. I was looking through one of my favorite radio books, the compilation of technical topics articles by G3VA. And one of the articles that he has in there is the history of ham radio beacons, the origin, the first use of beacons in ham radio. And he traces it back. I'm not sure whether he was saying this was the actual first use, but one of the first uses was actually during World War II on the German side. Apparently they used radio amateurs and radio frequencies to set up some beacons for, I think, for propagation studies. Anyway, I'll dig up that article and say some more about that. But it would be interesting if anybody has any comments or info on where the use of beacons in ham radio got its start. All right, I guess that's enough on QRSS and MEPT. Let's move now into the kind of the I don't know what we'd call this part, but I just want to let you guys know what was happening on some of the associated web pages and blog pages that I've set up. The T-shirt and bumper sticker store is open, and every once in a while I get an idea. I say, look, this would be fun. Let's put this on a T-shirt. Let's put this on a mug. Let's put this on a bumper sticker. They're not exactly selling like hotcakes, but let me tell you, it's kind of fun and creative to make these things. One of the bumper stickers that has been selling is the one about my other car. Have you guys heard about this one? This is the kind of bumper sticker that you want on your car if you're into this kind of stuff. And it just says, "My other car was homebrewed from junk box parts, solder smoke." And then www.soldersmoke.com. There are a couple of others in the works that I haven't quite finished the design on. One, I think I mentioned this before. It's the almost inevitable QRSS operators do it very slowly. And I hear you can almost hear Marvin Gaye with that deep voice saying that. The other one, stay tuned for this one, because I think this one might have some appeal. It's kind of a reaction to the real high tech radios that are out there that are kind of at the opposite end of the homebrew high tech commercial appliance operator spectrum. You guys know what I'm talking about, but this is kind of in my mind here. It's going to be a T-shirt. It might be on a mug. It'll definitely be on a bumper sticker. But the theme is basically menus are for restaurants. Real radios have knobs and switches. No offense to the software derived radio guys. You know what I'm talking about. Menus are for restaurants. Okay. All right. At the risk of being branded a Luddite, I'll put that one together. It'll certainly appeal to a certain segment of our audience. those of us who are at the low tech analog discrete component non-surface mount end of the construction continuum here. All right. Speaking of software, hey, I wanted to mention this to some of you guys who might not be aware of this, but you can subscribe to the blog and to the podcast, and this way you'll get an instant alert anytime something new is added or anytime we do a new show. Actually, the blog got its origin from a suggestion from our friend Ramakrishnan in India. He said, why don't you do a blog, and that way anytime something new happens with the podcast, we can get an alert. And so that was the origin of the Solder Smoke blog. But, when you subscribe to the blog or to the podcast, there's many different ways that you can get an alert. I think you can get alerts via emails. The way I do it is I use the iGoogle. We're all familiar with the Google page, but iGoogle is sort of a personalized Google homepage, and you could set it up for yourself, and you can include on that page all these little boxes, and some of the boxes could be news, you could have the weather, you could have a box displaying incoming email, and you could have little boxes for all of the various blogs and podcasts that you're interested in and that you've subscribed to. So, for example, I'm a big fan of K6HX's Brainwagon blog. So I have a little box on my screen that says on the top Brainwagon, and every time Mark posts a new article on there, I get a little alert, and it appears like on one box next over, one box over will be the New York Times, and when they put a new headline up on their newspaper, it's right there, and the right next to it is Brainwagon, and every time Mark puts up a new article, boom, it's right there, almost getting equal billing with the New York Times. Very appropriate, I think. So anyway, take a look at iGoogle. If you're not using it, maybe you should. It'll make your kind of ham radio web experience a lot easier, and then you could use it to subscribe to your favorite blogs and podcasts. I think it's a really useful tool. Just go to the Google page and look for iGoogle. It's very, very easy to set up. Hey, speaking of kind of internet news, I was happy to find that the Usenet is still in good shape. I had fallen away from the Usenet a couple of years ago. I was used to be a big fan, but then got away from it. And it seemed that for a while there, it was just totally bogged down with spam and junk mail and everything else. But something seems to have happened. I think Google got involved. Google is now, I think, running a big chunk of it. And somehow their spam filters seem to be working, because I've noticed that the signal-to-noise ratio in the Usenet, at least in the ham radio portions of it, has improved considerably. And so now I keep an eye, and I have on my iGoogle page a little box that shows the Usenet groups that I follow. I like to keep an eye on Rec Radio Amateur Homebrew, of course. Then there's Rec Radio Amateur Boat Anchors for the old radio stuff. I also keep an eye on Psi Electronics Basics, which is really good because it's a way to keep an eye on what's happening in the kind of non-ham radio electronic world. And I also Psi Astro Amateur for amateur astronomy. It's always good to keep an eye on that. But there's four or five different Usenet groups that I now keep an eye on, and very easy to get to through the services there of iGoogle. So check that out. These are potentially, well, they have been very, very useful ways for us to keep in touch with people of similar interests. Hey, I made it back to Echolink. I've been away from Echolink for a long time. Of course, this podcast got its start on Echolink, but for some reason I got away from it. And the other day, I guess I was up here early in the morning and said, you know, I should be in more direct two-way contact with my fellow radio amateurs. Enough of this one-way podcast stuff. Let's go out and talk to people. So I fired up Echolink. It was early in the morning here. And as I used to do quite frequently, I kind of went first to the VKZL section. And the very first guy I called was Kylie, ZL1KM. And it was really spooky, because I gave him a call, and he came back, and the very first thing he said to me was, "Oh, Bill, solder smoke, I'm a listener." I said, "Wow, you know, small world." I mean, we have two or 3,000 listeners out there, regular listeners. That's my estimate, but it was still kind of surprising that on my very first shot on solder smoke, the very first guy I call turns out to be a listener of the podcast. Of course, it was great. We had a nice talk. It was good to run into Kylie. He's got all kinds of interesting projects going there. And then I went over and logged on to one of my favorite Echolink stations. It's ZL1VK. in Papakura, New Zealand stations. New Zealand, they always have these really cool place names. These they must be Maori names, and they just. I remember my first real big DX. I think I told you guys was ZL2ACP in Waipawa. Wow. Well, ZL1VK in Papakura, and it's the Papakura Radio Club. And when you visit ZL1VK-L, the greeting that you get over Echolink is bird calls. Bird calls from New Zealand birds. And really, really wild sounding birds come on. And then they, after the birds do their thing for 30 seconds or so, then they give you the intro and welcome to the ZL1VK repeater. So check it out. If you guys are on there, check it out. You'll get a kick out of just listening to the birds. The bird calls change every few days also, guys. It's not just the same old birds. They have a variety of birds down there. And all of them, as far as I can tell, are getting their time on the ZL1VK repeater intro tape. I also jumped into the QRP conference the other morning. I got on very early, and I ran into Jerry NR5A and Alpha Delta 7 Bravo Papa and Kilo Bravo 0 Alpha Delta Delta. They have a regular kind of, I guess, a late night meeting there in the QRP conference on Echolink. Usually by the time I get on Echolink, it's so late in the United States that most people have signed off. But guys who are further west, the West Coasters, or even folks out in the plains or in the mountain states, some of them are still on. So that's what happened the other day, and I was really delighted to be able to talk to those fellows, and we had a nice round table. So I'm thinking that we should make, especially those of us who are here in Europe, we should make use of that QRP conference. It's pretty much empty during the day in Europe, but we could use that as sort of a watering hole, sort of a meeting point in Echolink for people who melt solder and generate solder smoke. So let's think about that. Shoot me an email if anybody wants to meet up there. But it would be, like I said, a convenient place for us to meet. And it's usually empty during the daylight hours in Europe. So let's think about that. But anyway, it's been great to get back to Echolink, and a lot of fun. The other thing that's going on, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, minimalism, minimal mania. There's a couple of new rigs that came out. Chris Trask, our man in the Sonoran Desert, has come up with a really cool little rig called the Gnat. The G-N-A-T, like the little bug. Chris is a big fan and an authority on the flora and the fauna of the Sonoran Desert. And I guess that's where the name for this particular rig comes from. But this is a really interesting rig, guys. Take a look at it. I have it up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Check it out. It's a one transistor rig, and in that sense, it's like the ET1 or the FE tier, but it's also very, very different because unlike the ET1 and FE tier, there's no switching involved. The rigs that were based on the MPF 102 are basically built on top of a four-pole double-throw switch, and the entire active device is switched over from transmit circuitry to receive circuitry. In my case, I built it up on the four-pole double-throw relay, which looks cool, but it has its problems because I think the voltage spike from that relay coil is what's been killing my MPF 102 JFETs. So anyway, the Gnat gets away from this problem completely because there is no switch, there is no relay. Chris Trask has designed a rig that when you put the key down, just the act of keying the transmitter does the switch over from transmit to receive. And I think that is really, really pretty cool. Also, it's designed around a 2N2222, and he says that you could think about a half a watt out from this thing, which makes QSOs entirely more possible than with the 18 milliwatts or so from the ET1. He also says that if you use a more robust transistor and change the output transformer on the transmitter, that it's possible to think of about 2 watts out. So we're getting really into the QRO area here, but three cheers for the NAT. The other rig that I've been looking at here, let me get my notes. I hope I have the guy's name. I have it up on the page. The other rig that really caught my attention is the NS40. NS stands for No Simpler. I guess this is something of a challenge. I don't think they probably didn't mean it that way, but it sort of reads that way. The No Simpler, the NS40, it comes out of the Four States QRP Club, and it's built around one transistor that operates as a Class E amplifier. It's got 14 parts. And for me, the coolest part of this rig is that all of the coils are etched into the PC board. So when you look at the PC board, you see these weird little swirls, these circular swirls there. And those are the coils for the rig. So there's no toroids, there's no chokes or anything else like that to wind. It's all wound into the NS40 PC board. I have a picture of this up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Check it out. I think you'll find this one really interesting. 14 parts, puts out 5 watts on 40, and the NS40 out of the Four States QRP Club. These are the folks that put together Ozarkon and all that. So really intriguing stuff happening at the minimalist end of the radio construction spectrum. I continue to work on my FE tier, and I guess this is the only real bit of technical progress that I can report. I mentioned that I've had some trouble because of my headphones. My headphones are not really high Z. They're very sensitive, but they're definitely not high Z. So in the version of the FE tier that appeared in the recent issue of Sprat, I couldn't really use the audio output circuit that was outlined by Roger in that article, because when I put my low Z headphones across the point where Roger was taking audio in his circuit, my low Z headphones just shut the whole thing down, and the regen detector stopped regening and stopped detecting and stopped oscillating and everything. So I had to use some kind of alternate circuit, and I went back to the circuit that had been employed by W2UW in his original ET1 circuit, and that is he ran the DC going into the receiver through the coils of the headphones. So the headphones were in series with the 12 volts or the 9 volts DC going to the regen detector. And that worked okay, but one of the problems was, though, that when I moved this, when I moved the headphones around, or if I moved the coils, it would shift the frequency of the detector, which was annoying. So obviously I needed kind of a high Z connection so that I wouldn't have to run the coils. I needed some isolation between the headphones and the regen detector. And so I cheated a little bit. This is supposed to be a one active device rig, but I just popped in one additional MPF 102 because they have such a high Z input there. And I just put the gate of that FET to the high Z point at which Roger had taken the output for his high Z crystal headphones. And then I rigged up the MPF 102 as a real simple audio amplifier, and just a little one-stage audio amplifier. Not so much for the amplification, although I do seem to be getting a little bit of gain, but more for the isolation so that I could isolate the headphones from the regen circuit. And it works because now I can move those headphones around and I'm not shifting frequency every time I turn my head. that was the technical innovation. I'm going to order some Hi-Z crystal headphones and get really minimalist and get that kind of offensive second transistor out of there. But this is just sort of a temporary measure. And the receiver is working quite well. It really does, it really pulls in the signals. And when 80 meters is, well, at just about all times during the day, 80 meter signals are really present in abundance in this little regen receiver. I haven't made any QSOs with it. That'll be coming up. I want to try to do that. I think I might have a tough time. I might have to resort to SCEDs with this one, but we'll see. Listen, what else have I been up to? Just little odds and ends stuff here. I decided to catalog my sprats to see what sprats I have and what sprats I'm missing. Let's see, the family is starting to wake up. I'm hearing movement out there. And I did a cataloging of my sprats and found, there he is. There's Billy. We've been talking about him. Billy has been down for maintenance. How you feeling this morning?
Bad.
You feeling bad? Really?
Tired.
Oh, man. Fever. Billy's got strep throat. Yeah. Might have. I don't know where he picked it up, but we got him on antibiotics, but he's been kind of under the weather here. Anyway, I did a cataloging of my sprats, found out which ones I'm missing, so now I know which ones I need to print out from that great CD that Tony Fishpool gave me. Billy was kind of teasing me the other day. He said that I must have practically memorized almost all the sprats because I've read them all 4, 5, 6 times. Every time I walk out of the house, I have 2 or 3 of them stuffed into my pockets. But anyway, we now know which ones I have not yet read, and I'm going to print those out. So this is going to open up a whole new world of reading for me. The other thing I'm going to do is I want to order the CD for the QRP Quarterly. I have a bunch of the old copies here in paper form, but I missed many, many, many of those, and so I want to take a look at getting the CD for that fine publication. So we're going to expand our QRP homebrew reading base. Let's see. All right. Where are we now? Oh, yeah. Bill, it's time for...
What?
Time for...
Sorry, smoke mail bag.
That's awesome.
Indeed. Yeah, QRP. Solder smoke mailbag. All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see. We got.
Awesome.
Yeah. Another. That's awesome. Yeah. All right. We get a lot of email from Jim AL7RV. Jim, as his call sign indicates, operates out of a mobile home and is in different locations at different times. He likes LT Spice. And he actually started out this his email exchange with me by cursing me for afflicting him with yet another area of electronic interest. But he likes LT Spice. He's climbed the learning curve. He finds it useful. Every once in a while, I get one of these messages from him, which he says, "Wow, I didn't know you could do that." And so he discovers some other feature of that amazing program. But you know what he misses, guys? He misses the smoke. He misses the actual smoke rising from the workbench when he puts a component in. So he told me that he's thinking of developing a PIC chip program, a program using a PIC chip. And what it would do is that every time he added a component in LT Spice, you know, he's working there on the screen, and every time he goes into the electronic virtual parts bin, pulls out a resistor and adds it to the circuit board in the simulator, that a little puff of solder smoke is emitted by a device that he would have located near the screen or near the keyboard to add a new level of realism to the simulation. I think that's a great thing. He's thinking about using a small heating pot to trigger a puff of solder rosin smoke every time a component is added. Jim, this is the kind of thinking that we need in the solder smoke world. I think you're onto something here. Let's add this feature to LT Spice. All right. Randy, K7 AGE. Randy, thanks very much for sending me. Randy sent me the video for Empire of the Air, the book that we've been talking about. And it's great to take a look at the video, and it brings so much of the book to life. So thanks for sending that along, Randy. And everybody should check out Randy's videos. He's got a really great YouTube video page. Just search for K7AGE. Really great stuff there. Jim, K9JM, responded to my questions about the kind of weird noises that sometimes come out of my little ET1 regen receiver. He says that it's probably caused by FMing of the regen oscillator, and I need to increase the Q of the coil in my regen receiver. But he warns that I shouldn't get my hopes up, because the regen receiver will never really stand up or compare favorably with the Drake 2B. He claims, he points out, I think accurately, that I've been spoiled by the Drake 2B. So, but thanks for the suggestion there, Jim. Rye, K9LCJ. Let's see. And it came in with a suggestion about he was responding to my discussion of my upside down FSK, and he says in the old days people were able to remember which way the keying was supposed to go on RTTY by a mnemonic called it was based on a tobacco commercial. The tobacco commercial was Lucky Strike Means Fine Tobacco, and the mnemonic was Low Space Means Fine Teletype. So I guess Rye is in agreement with the folks who have pointed out that my upside-down FSK is not aesthetically pleasing. So, one fellow pointed out that it looked like laundry being hung out to dry. But anyway, it's still upside down. I might get it right side up soon, but for now it's still upside down. But thanks for that, Rye. Alan, W2AEW, is on the road a lot. He listens to Solder Smoke. He has what could be the dream job for the radio amateur. He travels around as a field engineer for Tektronix, going around looking at their test gear at different sites in the Northeast, and he gets to do ham radio while he's on the road, because he's got a mobile rig with him. So you're driving around doing mobile ham radio, and when you get to the work site, you get to work on Tektronix gear. That sounds like one cool job to me. Thanks for writing in, Alan. Dave, W8NF, he was talking about different books about sort of in the Empire of the Air genre. He says that when he was in junior high school, he read another book called Armstrong, A Man of High Fidelity. What a great title. And he wonders if that book is more, as he put it, knack-worthy. I had commented that Empire of the Air was a little light in the technical department, but he's trying to remember back to high school days, junior high days, and he wonders, he's trying to remember whether Armstrong, A Man of High Fidelity, had a higher level of technical accuracy. If anybody knows, shoot me an email. We'll pass along the review. Mark in Indiana, he recently bought a copy of EMRFD, Experimental Methods in RF Design, and he reports that Wes has posted on his website updated programs, updated software to accompany the EMRFD. And I checked out the website, and indeed it's there. So if you visit the W7ZOI website, you'll find updated programs to accompany experimental methods in RF design. Mark, thanks for bringing that to our attention. Jonathan, KB1KIX, is a big Shep fan, big fan of Gene Shepherd. Jonathan has a really good a good blog, and you should check it out. Just do a Google search for KB1KIX. He's recently got a lot of really good information on the Smith chart on his page. So I've been meaning to dive into the Smith chart, and KB1KIX's blog page would be a good place to start. I mentioned Jerry NR5A. Jerry's building a QRSS rig, and he was using a Radio Shack experimenter board, one of these little plug-in boards. I had one. I got rid of it, and I regret getting rid of it, because every time I look at one of Michael AA1TJ's projects, he usually starts out putting together his rigs on one of those little plug-in Radio Shack boards. So that makes me think that there's use for these devices, especially I think when working on these logic chips that I was playing with. Certainly be better than the technique that I used, Jerry has been having some trouble with those boards, and he told me that he switched back over to Manhattan, and things worked a little bit better. But Jerry is putting an MEPT QRSS transmitter together, and hopefully we'll soon be seeing SIGs from South Dakota on the QRSS network. George, K8VU, he wrote in. George has been helping me. George is the editor on the Solder Smoke book that is nearing completion. Anyway, I included in sort of the intro to one of the chapters the quote from Dilbert about Dilbert, the dialogue that took place when Dilbert's mom took him to the doctor to find out what was wrong with him, because he took everything apart and built ham radios and things like that. And there was a part in there where it wasn't quite clear from the audio what the doctor was saying. And I had heard it as him saying that he will have symptoms of and other social ineptitudes, which really didn't make any sense. And George listened to it more carefully, and he's got the quote better. And the doctor says that that young Dilbert is, he describes the symptoms of the knack, one of them being utter social ineptitude. So we got that straight, and that certainly is the symptom. So thanks for straightening us out on that, George. I mentioned David VK6DI, the grabber operator in Western Australia, is going to be shutting down. He's going to be moving back to VK2. He's moving back to the Australian East Coast. So in April, that VK6 area grabber that has been so useful for us is going to be going out of operation. And I now issue a call to all VK6 land radio amateurs. Please come up with a new grabber for that part of the world. We'll really miss David's grabber when he moves east. So we're hoping that somebody else will pick up the baton there and continue with grabber operations in VK6 land. David, thanks for all your work over the years in keeping that grabber on the air. Paul, K3PG, recently went on a ski vacation with the family, and here's dedication, guys. He took with him some parts for his Willamette 20 rig, and while on breaks from the ski vacation, had family relatives help him wind coils and stuff. So we hope that project's coming together well for you there, Paul. And he's also getting back to work on his Soft Rock 40. I need to get to work on mine. It's sitting here. Those SMT parts are calling me. The last bit of Solder Smoke mailbag that we have this week comes to us from Paul, WA0P, I think I got it right, PWK, from Steve, WA0PWK. And he found something in an old Hints and Kinks that I think is really interesting. It's a cartoon, one of the Gill cartoons, W1CJD was the cartoonist for many years for QST and the ARRL publications. We all love Gil's cartoons. And I didn't know, but Gil did a cartoon, a caricature of our friend Wes, W7ZOI. I don't even know if Wes, I'm sure Wes remembers it, but it's from way back. I'd never seen it before. And Steve sent it to me. And if Wes gives me the okay, if Wes gives me the thumbs up, I'll put it up on the Blogspot page. It's it's really kind of nice, and I'm sure Wes won't have any objection. But I'll wait till I get the thumbs up. I always check with Wes before I do anything like this. So if Wes says it's okay, I'll put it up on the Blogspot page, and you guys will be able to see it. Thanks for sending that along, Steve. All right, guys, we're a little bit over time. So much happening. I hope you enjoyed that one. Keep all those projects going. Keep that solder melted, and have a real good week ahead. I hope the spring arrives soon. I know everybody's getting tired of winter. 7-3 from Rome.